I'm going to call this House Committee on Economic Development to order for Wednesday, May 29th, 2019. I'm going to open an informational hearing on economic development investment and incentive review. And are you coming up first, Chris?
Mind if I bring a colleague up as well?
The undirected.
Well, I don't know. We'll wait.
We'll wait till he talks.
I'll bring him up and see. Sorry. He's always welcome.
Okay.
Chair Lively, committee members, for the record, I'm Chris Harder, Director of Business Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to present today. While one of my colleagues is already up here, I'm going to provide some context for both his presentation and, if we get to him, some follow-on presentations as well. So that will be the first part here. Wanted to kind of take some time to put into context the programs you're about to hear about. So as part of that approach, wanted to kind of make clear how we approach economic development more broadly, and then how these programs you're going to hear about fit into that. So how we approach our work is both broad and deep. It includes rural community development and infrastructure financing, business retention, expansion and recruitment, export promotion and international trade, investments in industry research and development and innovation, technical assistance and financial support to small businesses, and support for arts and cultural organizations. In all, the agency oversees more than 70 distinct programs. No one program or body of work is sufficient for prosperity for all Oregonians, which is our agency's vision statement. It is the total package working together that enables us to pursue economic growth and prosperity. A good example of this comprehensive approach, because again, these programs aren't really utilized necessarily in isolation, is a recent project in Hermiston. Lamb Weston, a major food processor in eastern Oregon, was considering sites in Oregon and outside of the state to expand. A key factor in their decision to expand in Oregon was access to the Greater Hermiston Area Enterprise Zone, a business incentive program you'll hear more about later today from a colleague of mine next to me, Art Fish. A component of the enterprise zones are what we call community fees, paid by the recipient company to local communities, and in this case, this fee was about $1 million. A portion of this fee was used to help the city of Hermiston take on a loan with Business Oregon through our agency's Special Public Works Fund to implement much-needed community water system improvements. So in short, why I give that example is to emphasize how our programs, the 70-plus, actually work together. Accessing an existing business incentive program allowed us to competitively secure private sector investment and job creation in a rural Oregon community, and it then leveraged financing for much-needed water system improvements for the broader Hermiston area. These are the outcomes that we pursue at the agency. Our broader economic development role and suite of programs, the 70-plus, have also been influenced by this body, the legislature. So over the years, Business Oregon has been asked to oversee new programs and initiatives important to the state. A few of them are listed on this slide. Several more are being considered in this legislative session. I bring this up just to say that how we define economic development is also defined by you guys as well. I'm not going to go into this in a ton of detail because I've presented on our strategic plan in the past, but I do want to pull out some highlights here. So about a year and a half ago, we unveiled our five-year strategic plan.
Yep. Hey, thank you so much, Chair Lively, and I apologize for the interruption. Would you mind going back a slide?
Yep.
You have my attention.
Okay.
On the new market tax credit.
Yep.
It says sunset 2016.
Yes.
It sunsetted in 2016?
Yes.
Okay. I've seen that be very successful in certain very specific circumstances. I'm wondering if there are any conversations about renewing the new market tax credit?
There have been, and I think at the time, at the last session, as an agency, we recommended some updates and changes to the program, should that be not sunsetted. It did sunset, so we're more than willing to have kind of ongoing conversations about the program. There's still a federal program that is active in the state. It's the state portion of that that has sunsetted. We still have projects under the New Market Tax Credit Program, and we'll monitor and oversee those until those come to fruition, if that makes any sense.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I just thank you for the update. I wasn't aware that had happened, but I'm very interested in, so sure. Appreciate it.
Okay. Yep. So again, we unveiled a new strategic plan that guides everything we do at Business Oregon. And it was the purpose of our strategic plan was twofold. One was to position the agency to better close existing economic gaps, and I'll get into some of those. And the second was to actually unite our 70 plus programs around common priorities and objectives to really reinforce how they work together. Core questions we ask when implementing on our strategic plan are, who benefits? Or how can we promote shared prosperity? More detailed questions as we get into different programs come about, such as how can our programs better serve communities of color, women, Native and tribal populations? What opportunities exist for us to create more economic opportunity for rural communities? Or how can we better address existing market failures related to innovation and access to capital for small businesses? So on the screen, you can see we have five overarching priorities that guide our work in these 70 programs. As an agency, they do actually represent some shifts for us, this current biennium and how we approach our work. Some of those shifts are an emphasis on elevating state investments in innovation to grow Oregon's economy through increased investments in research and development and technology innovation. Targeting our business development efforts to particularly focus on small and medium-sized companies, building local economic development capacity in rural communities through prioritized investments in infrastructure, job creation, and business expansion, and explicitly committing to equitable outcomes for underrepresented populations, particularly through investments that counter systemic barriers to economic opportunity. So what does that mean? Like, what does this actually look like in practice? So here are what examples that we've implemented this biennium to kind of help shift our work around these five priorities. The first one is the development and adoption of a public benefits framework tied to key business incentive programs. I'm going to discuss this in more detail when we get to the Governor's Strategic Reserve Fund. It also applies to our business expansion program. It is represented in social impact investments that we've made through the Oregon Growth Fund. Several funds to just call out: Accelerate Fund, the Inclusive Startup Fund, the Women's Venture Fund, and Ascent Lending are all organizations or funds that we've invested in that have explicit focus on promoting and supporting women and minority entrepreneurs. We've instituted regional offices to better serve rural communities. 90% of infrastructure finance resources and 50% of business development resources went to rural communities this biennium. Now we have a couple probably projects still hanging out there as we close it out, but those numbers are pretty solid. We've also redesigned the Oregon Innovation Council to focus more on investments in research and development and new product development versus ongoing operational support for organizations. We've created a new lending tool called the Oregon Royalty Fund to fill a documented capital gap for small businesses. And we have changed our approach of how we look at the Strategic Reserve Fund and included capacity building investments. Again, I'm gonna get into that a little bit more detail when I get to SRF. So to shift gears, that was meant to just kind of put in context how we view all of our programs and certainly the ones you're about to hear about today. So with that, I'm gonna kind of shift gears and we're gonna walk through various business incentives. I'm gonna take the Strategic Reserve Fund and Art's gonna take the remainder of them. So I'll kind of tee it up and we'll go from there. So when it comes to businesses making expansion or recruitment, site selection decisions, talent, cost, quality of life, and access to markets, both international and domestic, are the biggest determining factors for where they site. Oregon is competitive on all four factors, but what order a company prioritizes these four factors will vary by industry and certainly by kind of unique project drivers. In general, Oregon's overall cost structure is competitive when compared to other states. Some of our costs are higher, some of our costs are lower. For example, our corporate and personal income taxes are often higher than competitor states, but we also don't have a sales tax, and that can be seen as a benefit, certainly when you compare us to other states. Utility rates are average when compared to California and Washington, the two markets that we most often compete with. Oregon labor costs are a significant advantage for us.
Yep. Mr. Harder, Representative Drazen.
Thank you, Director Harder. I just wanted to ask you, we don't have a sales tax in Oregon, but we did just adopt the gross receipts tax. Yeah. Does that change this presentation in any way, shape, or form? How does that affect this?
Yeah, you probably have to kind of look at that more thoroughly to be able to answer that at the moment. Yeah.
More.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, Chris, but a sales tax doesn't necessarily affect businesses in that they don't, you know, they typically don't pay sales tax on either their cost of goods or other items, too. I mean, sales tax is mostly from the general or to the general public. So go ahead. No, don't go. So when you're talking about incentives, you know, for businesses to relocate, I don't look at a sales tax so much as being a part of the criteria, except it raises the cost of living in that state, you know, for your employees and others. But as far as the cost of doing business, tell me how that affects the cost of doing business.
I'm not presenting taxes as an incentive at the moment. I'm presenting that when businesses make decisions about where to expand and not, cost is one of those factors. So as we look at, then when we get into incentives, it's a way to kind of understand where does Oregon stand, how valuable are incentives, certain incentives or not. Art, if you want to, did you want to?
Chair Lively, Vice Chair Fahey, Bonham, Representative Barreto, honorable members of the House Economic Development Committee. My name is Art Fish. And just to your point, we definitely have tried to make a point about the advantages of not having a sales and use tax, and those will continue. And businesses do pay quite a bit of sales and use tax through the things that they buy, the supplies, anything that really doesn't go into the actual production stream. And this has been very instrumental in attracting data centers to Oregon, for example. However, I think it is, I think for the reasons you stated, sometimes that advantage is lost on companies and they don't see it because it gets just intermingled with the cost of the things they buy.
The availability of incentives does vary from state to state, so to put how our portfolio stacks up to other states. But in general, some level of incentives are a pretty standard part of the competitive business expansion recruitment process. The size of our flexible cash incentives are lower than most competitor states. Our property tax incentives are comparable to many states. So when we refer to business incentives, which we're about to get into, we commonly refer to, when we say those, it's a suite of programs. It's the Governor's Strategic Reserve Fund, our business expansion program, the Strategic Investment Program, the Oregon Investment Advantage Program, and the Enterprise Zone Program. So time permitting, we're going to start walking through kind of each of these, and we look forward to the conversation today. If we have time, we'll also, we have another colleague of mine here today, Carrie Baxendall, who is available to walk through one of our certification programs for business inclusion and diversity. So to start, is the Governor's Strategic Reserve Fund, which is our most flexible discretionary incentive program that we have at the state. So this biennium, we've awarded 22 SRF projects. We have a couple more in the pipeline, so I expect that to grow actually this month. Those 22 projects, however, have helped create more than 1,000 new jobs and retain more than 2,000. They have leveraged more than $435 million in new private investment to the state. Seven of the projects are located in urban areas, 15 in rural communities. This really starts to emphasize our priority about meeting rural needs.
Representative McEwen.
Yep. Thank you, Chair Lively. And Chris, thank you for being here today. This is just very interesting, I think, for all of us. I am really curious about how you leverage $435 million with 5.3. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, so one of the key roles of Governor's Strategic Reserve Fund is to fill kind of a gap, kind of that last hurdle to move a project over the finish line. So often there's a capital stack to put a project, but there is a remaining gap, and this is one of the ways we can use SRF to push it over. So an incentive like this doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, tens and 20 millions of dollars. It could be, you know, a couple hundred thousand up to a million that help kind of make this project complete in whole and move it forward. And, you know, everything we do in this regard is usually in competition with another state who's offering similar or like-minded packages.
Sure. Can you give us an example of a return like that?
Oh, gosh, I can. I have examples of projects later on. I don't necessarily get specifically into the investment numbers, but we can follow up and can they're actually all on our website of what our investments go to and then what's the overall project investment. So we can compile that.
Kind
and
of
that
eye-popping.
To you. Yeah.
So.
Yeah,
thank you.
For sure.
Yeah. Chris, so one of the questions that remains about these programs is, so the numbers that we're using here, 1,086 new jobs, are, so people ask, so how do we know that? So how do we verify and prove if that's what our claim is? Mm-hmm. So what documentation and proof do we have that that's so?
Sure. We arguably have the most conservative employment tracking in the country as it relates to our jobs. And you should know the SRF is by far the primary driver of our job creation KPM, which is, you know, what we report on to the legislature. It's dominant. Don't quote me on a percent, but I would put it up there at 70-80% of that KPM is driven by just this program alone. So when a company comes on board, and assuming it's a job creation SRF, I'm going to get into a little bit that not all of our SRFs are job creation SRFs. But if it is, we get confidential employment data from the employment department that tracks the actual jobs created. So it's not projected. We come after the fact, and every year we look and we monitor those. It's the confidential data that gets very specific that we have access to through an intergovernmental agreement. So it's very conservative tracking.
But part of the agreement to for you to make the investment, or the state to make the investment, is a certain number of jobs, or it's just jobs, or how did? Is that different? Different in programs.
Yes, and I'll get into that into a little bit. Each project is different. The number of jobs, whether it's creation or retention, or like I said, I'm going to show you some examples that aren't necessarily job creation. Those are very project specific, and those can vary depending on some. But I'll give some examples in just a bit.
Oh, that's an agreement. Sorry.
I'm up really quickly.
Yeah.
So this same number that Representative McKeown was referencing, I'm just curious. Does that mean that these businesses had exhausted all other alternatives and they were 90% ready to go? They needed that last 10%. The state was their last resort option, and these jobs and that investment would not have occurred otherwise? Or are you just partnered alongside and there would have been additional private investment or loans or some other mechanism to complete these projects?
It depends on the project. So in many cases, we're filling the gap to create the capital gap. So in that case, yes, it could be a missing certain amount of money, and we're able to kind of fill it with this flexible tool. In other cases, to be quite honest, it's a but-for in the sense of we're in competition with a location in Idaho, and they're offering a package at this level, and what makes us competitive, we're often outbid on the amount of incentives, but if we can get close and you add that to some of our other attributes of why companies locate here, that package is what makes us competitive. So it really does depend project by project, but those are the most common. I'm going to get into part of the reason we use SRF is also to secure public benefits. And that's a change that we made this biennium, and I'm going to walk through. I have a slide in about two slides that's going to get into. So part of the reason we use SRF is to ensure that we're also getting more localized community benefits through our economic development work as well. So,
Representative Fahey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If companies accept these funds, do they need to commit to a certain number of jobs created, and that's going to vary by project? Or what kinds of commitments do they need to enter into to be eligible for these funds?
Give me like two slides, and I'll walk through all this if that works. Yeah. So it makes me confident that we have the right slides and content coming up. So. So just as a reminder, we have two types of SRF projects in general. One is what we call job creation and retention SRFs. This is to help secure business recruitment, retention, expansion projects. Companies are required under these types of SRFs to maintain current workforce levels and or create new jobs. Some recent examples of SRFs that have been jobs focused are a Wayfair, which was a business recruitment in Springfield that's bringing 600 new jobs to that community. The North River Boats, 20 new jobs in Roseburg. Owyhee Produce, 40 new jobs in Ontario. These are job SRFs where we have strict requirements about how many they're going to make. The other type of SRF are what we call capacity building. So these aren't necessarily to incent new jobs, but they're investments in broader community needs or to move, in many cases, an emerging industry forward. So some examples of those, and I'll actually get into real detailed examples in a little bit. And examples of these capacity building would be investments in rural prosperity. So we use the Strategic Reserve Fund to launch a rural broadband capacity pilot program. I think we have 7 communities under that program at the moment. That's an example. Another one was an investment in marine infrastructure. We made an investment in Hayak Tongue Point in Astoria to help kind of a port facility there attract business. We also make investments in innovation entrepreneurship. So a recent one was an investment in the Oregon Blockchain Venture Studio. It's a startup accelerator, and that's one of my examples coming up.
So, Representative Fahey, did you have a before we move on?
So for the job space programs, where you've given examples of the commit to creating this many jobs, what happens if they don't deliver on that?
We have a clawback, and I'm going to get to that.
Okay.
Yep. So if they don't create jobs, they pay us it back, and I'll get to some of those provisions in the next slide. Projects typically come through our regional development officers, so we have 12 of those around the state, and they're usually proposed as kind of concepts around project funding and active recruitment expansion projects. They then enter a kind of internal agency evaluation period where we look at everything from what's the overall economic impact of a project. We do a financial review. So if they don't meet it, are they able to pay back? These come in the form of loans, and then they're forgiven if they meet requirements. So if they don't meet requirements, do they have the financial backing to pay back? Or what is the risk should that be in question? We're very transparent about that. We also make sure that these projects align with our agency's strategic plan priorities that had on the screen earlier. Should it make it through that process, and not all of our projects certainly don't, they don't. Final approval then requires a signature from the governor. So that's the partnership that we have directly with the governor and the governor's office. In partnership with the governor's office, we did implement a pretty significant change to how we operate the Strategic Reserve Fund this biennium, and that is was the creation of a public benefits framework. And I'm going to walk through that, and then I'm going to get to some examples in detail about what these projects look like. So our public benefits are designed with a win-win orientation. Actually a win-win-win orientation. We want the company, the community, and the local state government to benefit from a project where we make an award through this program. In terms of public benefits, these are the kind of the 4 categories that we look at in order to structure those for each deal. And each deal is going to be unique, but these are the 4 kind of common benefits. I'm going to walk through those in a little bit more detail. So the first one is workforce development, and I would also add to that equitable job access. So in examples of public benefits that we've included in Strategic Reserve Fund awards include first source hiring agreements to ensure unemployed or underemployed or traditionally difficult to employ workers are priorities for job openings. We've had requirements related to company-wide career ladder programs with documented internal promotion targets. We've had requirements related to company internship programs to help develop employment pipeline and expose youth to career opportunities. Those are examples of public benefits that we include in our awards related to workforce development. Diversity, equity, inclusion. Sometimes we look for the adoption of formal diversity, equity, inclusion policies and strategies as a forgiveness requirement. Targeted recruitment of underserved populations, such as veterans, women, LGBTQ, disabled persons, communities of color, Native and tribal populations, and immigrants are often targets that we ask for. In regards to community engagement, we've asked for at times the adoption of plans to increase the amount of goods and services purchased from local businesses. So what are some requirements that we can put in place if we're giving, for example, an incentive? Commitments to support employees with transit or childcare needs. Hosting community events so that we have corporate partners that are active in their communities, and company contributions to local nonprofits and sanctioned community service volunteer opportunities, all examples of kind of community engagement requirements that we include. And then the fourth one, wind, and admittedly this one is the one we're working on and developing right now, is around environmental sustainability. So when we're working on projects, how can we also incent good environmental stewardship? These are the four buckets to our public benefits program. I'm going to walk through two examples of how this actually plays out now to provide some context to this, if that helps. The first one is Wayfair. So this was a recruitment of a Wayfair as an e-commerce company. It was a recruitment of the company to Springfield. They took over kind of an abandoned plant. I think it was the Hynix facility there. Or in the process of doing so. The SRF award was used to make us competitive as we competed against other states. So in this one, these come in terms of loans, and then if they meet certain requirements, we forgive them. That's the incentive. So certainly on this one, it's a job creation SRF. So there are requirements around the creation of 600 new full-time equivalent jobs. So should they not create 600, let's say they only create 550, we actually claw back the pro rata or the prorated amount per job calculation there. So in this case, it was $667 per job. So you times that by 10, and that's what they would pay back to us. In some cases, companies, you know, thought they were going to create all these jobs and don't, then the full amount gets clawbacked. But that's one of our clawback provisions. But we also claw back on meeting public benefit requirements. So some examples of the public benefit requirements that we included in this recruitment and this incentive for Wayfair include requiring the company to work with local and state partners, such as Lane Workforce Partnership, the City of Springfield, Oregon Department of Human Services, and others to implement DEI practices to target the recruitment of underserved populations. So veterans, women, LGBTQIA, disabled, other demographic groups. So we're looking for them to make measurable hiring decisions there. Now, while we can't legally require that, what we've done is that combination of organizations are setting targets for the company, and meeting those targets is what will trigger the public benefit forgiveness requirement. Another example is they're required to do a first source hiring agreement to ensure unemployed, underemployed workers are priority targets for their open jobs. Other examples in our public benefits on this incentive include the company, Wayfair, working with local and state partners to develop and implement an internship program. This company has one in Boston called the Year Up program, and it's been very effective. So part of their forgiveness requirement is to stand up a like program here in Oregon or in Springfield. And then they also have requirements around local and statewide matching programs for local and statewide charities. So those are actual requirements put into our award letters that if they, and I didn't even actually read them all, if they don't meet those requirements, then the entire SRF award gets clawed back, similar to the job creation. So from a clawback perspective, we require both the jobs to be created and have a kind of a clawback mechanism there, and we require all these public benefits to be met in order for them, for their loan to be forgiven.
Is there something in the amount of the loan that reflects they have some additional value for doing these things, or does that make any difference?
No, this is this is us saying for us to put public dollars on the table to encourage you to come here. We obviously have a see a benefit in the jobs being created, but we're also looking for community partners.
So if they create 600 jobs and next year they leave, do we get the money back?
Yeah, so they have to create jobs for a certain period of time. They can't just create them once and then the next day lay them off.
Okay.
They actually have to hold the jobs for 8 consecutive quarters. And they have, depending on the project, some of the time, so it's always 8 consecutive quarters. But sometimes they have, in this case, oh gosh, it's right here. They have a 3-year period to create the 600 and then hold them for 8 consecutive quarters. So. So another example, I want to give another example around these public benefits that's not a job creation one. And that one has to do with the investment we made in the Oregon Blockchain Venture Studio. Mm-hmm. Venture Studio is just another term for a startup incubator. So they provide mentoring and make actually equity investments into these companies. I won't get into blockchain because I don't want to get over my skis and actually trying to describe blockchain. The equivalent would be probably the impact like cloud computing has had on our economy and other things. So it's seen as likely to be a very significant impact to our economy globally, but certainly here in Oregon. So some of the public benefit requirements that we included in this SRF award was 40% of the startups that are enrolled or selected for this program must include underrepresented demographics as part of their leadership team. So again, women, people of color. So it's really trying, we're really trying to focus to make sure we have diversity as we make these investments. We're also requiring this Oregon Blockchain Venture Studio to partner with Portland State University as they're standing up the first in the country blockchain graduate certificate program. So they're going to be providing kind of the industry perspective around curriculum development, development of an internship program, academic partnerships. It's also a requirement we have. We're requiring this venture studio to host blockchain technology community events and workshops to target traditionally underserved youth. Again, other examples. So in this case, we have a list of public benefit requirements that they need to meet all of them in order for our loan of, I think on this one was $450,000 to help stand up this new venture studio or accelerator program. They have to meet all of our public benefit requirements for that to be forgiven. If they don't, then they pay that $450,000 back.
So we put in $450,000, then how much total money was put into the project then besides ours?
$4 million. So other partners, private sector partners, like I think Moda Health is involved. They're listed in here, sorry. They're in our memo here. Umpqua Bank, OHSU, PSU, I believe there's conversations with some of our Fortune 500s currently underway on some of this stuff. Those partners are contributing $3,550,000.
Okay.
As a state, we are providing $450,000. So this gets a little bit to how do you get from that $5 million to the big number? You can see the kind of leverage scale. And this, I can tell you this amount very much, they need this. They need the $4 million to operate this program for 2 years, and hopefully they have a longer-term goal of that. So this is really the bud for. They needed the money in. And in some cases, our money was actually some of the first money in to help encourage the private sector to invest in a similar, to invest in this approach here. So with that, I just wanted to highlight, so that's the Strategic Reserve Fund. Again, it's one of our most, it's our most flexible discretionary incentive tool. It's what we use for a lot of our recruitment expansion projects, but it's only one of them. And so I see some questions, but I'm gonna quickly here turn it over to Art Fish to walk through the remainder of them, but let's get to the maybe the questions.
I just have an overarching question. What is the budget for the Strategic Reserve Fund?
I think this biennium, it's close to a little over $7 million, but we just went through Ways and Means Subcommittee, and so our next biennium, it's looking to be more like 6.2, so it did take a cut. And it used to be more 10 or 12 million.
I was gonna say, are you up on it? Are you down, up? Where are you over a period of time?
Loose numbers, we're about 50% of what it looked like bienniums, a couple bienniums ago.
Okay.
So as we've made cuts through the legislative process, as agencies have.
And if you were capitalized where you think you could be most strategic, what would that number be?
That's probably a better question for some of the staff who are more closely there. But I think we certainly have a pipeline of projects that far exceeds the 6.2 or what we have this biennium. I think we often have several million more, so 10 to 12 million would be a rough, but I could get a more precise answer to that.
Close enough.
Okay.
Appreciate the context.
Yeah.
So we get partway through the biennium. Yeah. So you talk about you have more in the pipeline than we have funds for. So yeah. I'm trying to decide, given that, and we have 2 years to get through, so what part of the decision making involves keeping some funds to later in case you don't miss that big project versus just if you have a lot of good projects, funding it and running out of money?
Well, if we don't commit the funds, they've typically been swept. So they're not typically rolled over, just for clarification there. Again, we have, it's one of the balances that we do. We don't, we save these resources because we never know when a project opportunity is gonna present itself. So it's not really a tool that we can say at the beginning of the biennium, make your best proposals. If we did that, we would have lost out on Wayfair. And the two examples I just gave mm-hmm. were ones that have come in the last 6 or so months. So we definitely evaluate them along the way. Again, our pipeline is bigger. Not every project makes it through our own process. Not every project signed by the governor. At sometimes businesses back out of an expansion or a recruitment, they make other decisions. So right now, I think with a month left, we're scheduled to commit most of those funds, but something could change in the next month that would put some of it. So if we don't expend it all, it's usually swept. And then we get the new pot for the next biennium.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
So with that, I'm gonna turn it over to Art to walk through the remainder of the business incentive programs.
Very good.
Which are these right here, which I already talked about.
Well, thank you, Director Harder. That was excellent. And again, my name is Art Fish, and I'm more of a technician at the agency. And I love to talk about these things, but I'll try to summarize the questions that the chair gave to us. The part of the, and you can just go back, I guess, to the, do we have business expansion program at the end? Well, whatever. Well, you'll get them.
You'll get
them.
Do I do first?
Yeah, let's do that one. Or have that one up first.
This one, let me, one point of clarification, if you don't mind. This program doesn't have its own pot of money. If we use it, it actually comes out of the strategic reserve fund pot. That's why it makes sense to actually talk about these together. So it's not a separate pot of money, but it is a different mechanism from the same pot.
Yeah, so it's a good segue.
Yeah.
But I would contrast with the strategic reserve fund that this part of our toolbox are the more programmatic or statutory types of programs. And of course, it's important with that kind of thing to have good program design. And there's been bad incentives in Oregon and other places. The ones we're talking about today, I think, are tried and tested. Another thing to remember about any incentive is they're not here to make a bad project good. They're just a piece of the puzzle to help drive things along and, you know, in combination with other factors and resources, as the director alluded to. In Oregon, you know, we do have very potent property tax incentives, to say the least. And of course, if a project's really big, then that property tax incentive is very potent. We haven't used much in regards to income taxes in Oregon. We certainly don't, we do have a big sales and use tax exemption, but that's, you know, that's implicit. But with income taxes, we have no tax credits now, presently, that are involved with economic development. We had a few that were pretty good, but they've gone away, they've sunsetted, just as we mentioned in one case. Another thing about our emphasis on property tax exemptions, of which this isn't one, is that, you know, it's very local. So there's an important thing to the local character here. But even this program, which is you know, more of a direct fund, is in this case very programmatic or statutory. That is the BEP. And I would just refer you to some other pieces. But just moving on to BEP here, a lot of what I would say, that, or what the director had to say, actually, about how it's clawed back if the amount of jobs or whatever falls short is true. In this case, however, with the business expansion program, it has some very particular criteria, very high ones. And so its purpose is really inducing very singular opportunities with sizable payroll. And, you know, and we base the incentive on that expected payroll return. So actually, in this case, it's very formally calculated, a sort of incremental personal income tax revenue from the new very high quality jobs is calculated. And if that amount, based on the actual data that comes in through the, you know, UI or payroll tax records, which this and SRF are really plugged into technically, and it falls short of that number, then that amount is clawed back. So it's sort of this self-regulating forgivable loan system again, like with the Strategic Reserve Fund, except in this case, it's just more tied to how the program is based on a certain level of very well-paying jobs and the amount of personal income tax revenue that was expected in return at a very quick rate. So it has a very high payback ratio and has worked very well and has been a very instrumental piece, but only we do like over 8 years, one a year. So it's a very singular types of thing, and it fills a very important niche. Yes,
so Art, is the amount of money available in this directly tied? So is the 2 years income tax returns based on the 50 jobs, is that the amount of money then they can get in the loan or the whatever it is?
If they could produce more, it could be based on more jobs, but they would have to be at that same 150% level.
It has to be minimum 50, but right. It could be 100, and then they would qualify for larger. Doesn't necessarily mean quote unquote qualify for that.
Yeah, okay. We could always set it at a much lower level as far as the award goes, and commensurately what the requirement is to do it. So. It is tied to strategic. We don't get that actual revenue to fund this program like a rebate, but it's just part of the Strategic Reserve Fund budget. So
this program is stackable with others. So they could get this program, they could get enterprise loan, the community could get some funds through the infrastructure. I mean, there's multiple things to make a project this could be part of.
Yeah, I think for a very special project, I mean, we would look at, I mean, if they can't use an enterprise zone or something, that would be more a case for bringing this or Strategic Reserve Fund forward. But if, you know, there could be cases where layering made good sense, too. So with that, I just move on to the things that are really more actual tax abatements. You know, and I mean, there's pros and cons. I mean, they're not interchangeable as far as whether you use tax preferences or direct funding. They all have their benefits. The first, and I have this chart in OLIS, and I just bring it to your attention because it kind of shows of, and we can go back to that sort of original thing. We've got two enterprise zone programs, Oregon Investment Advantage, which is an income tax base, and then the Strategic Investment Program. And the Strategic Investment Program enterprise zones are also, of course, very locally, and our role at the agency is sort of a partial role. We don't run the whole show by any stretch of the imagination. But the standard enterprise zone program, which I'm going to go to next, as you can see in this chart, is the busy, busy program, hundreds of companies involved, whereas the other three, the other enterprise zone programs, SIP, Strategic Investment Program, and OIA, are really more niche players in a very sort of for very special or more or less rural types of situations. So I just bring that to your extension here. And getting into the standard enterprise zone, it's very statutory. Everything's based on law here. It's the 3 to 5 year exemption. And the 3 years is pretty much as of right anywhere in the state. So it's about as statutory as you can get. The extension to 5 years is based on local decision. And by property value, they average about 4 years in general, or 4.1 years in total. So it's a pretty short turnaround as far as the property that's been exempt. It's not a deferral. They actually don't pay those property taxes for 4 years on new property. And then afterwards, the property would be taxable. The program has quite a bit of form work. It's very rigorous through the Department of Revenue as far as the forms that we work with the Department of Revenue to design, as far as keeping companies plugged in and working through a variety of local partners around the state the basic job requirement is very simple. It's kind of simple to measure, simple to meet. Some companies that have a lot of employees, of course, would find it difficult to add 10% more. But if you're starting from zero or very little, it's just one new job. This program has been around quite a while. That is the Standard Enterprise Zone program. And we've defined its purpose as really for the betterment of the state, directing some particular assistance, primarily through tax incentives, at the choice of local governments to areas that have some special needs to stimulate employment, business, industry, and so forth. And over many years, we've had jurisdictions, not everyone, but we're up to about 200 cities, ports, and counties that have chosen to rely on this repeatedly as a tool, both because of its ability to contribute to the property tax base after a few years, as well as the job jobs that kind of come in at about 1,000 to 2,000 a year as far as new jobs through this program in the various zones across the state. And these have been very good businesses by and large over the years. And so with that, I just note that,
Representative Fahey.
Thank you. So what, similar question to my last one, what happens if a business doesn't meet the jobs requirement in the 3-year exemption or the wages requirement in the 5-year exemption?
Chair Lively, Vice Chair Fahey, members of the committee, the law clearly provides for the payback of all property taxes. And we work with, it's up to the county assessors, ultimately, their tax collectors and the Department of Revenue to pull that plug. But we work with them as well as local sponsors and everything. And, through their constant annual submission of forms and checking on the jobs and the local contacts, we do disqualify a few companies every year, and they pay back, or they make some arrangement for a 1 year if they can kind of get by for a year and they just pay off the sponsor for a year. Well, I shouldn't put it that way. But in any event, it is a full payback if during the course of the exemption period they fall short.
And is there, is it your sense that if someone falls short, it's 100% of the time we get the funds back? Or in what circumstances would we not get them?
Yes, I would say it's 100% of the time, unless there's some sort of foreclosure issue that comes up.
Okay.
I think that has occurred at times that, they've left town. Obviously, we're talking about assets that can't be moved, but so generally it's there to sell off, but you might have some issues with what you sold off and relative to the value. So there probably have been times, once they get disqualified, I lose touch with the whole thing, but yeah.
And what does it mean? I have gotten some data from the transparency site, and it says if you failed to meet the hiring commitment, there's some projects that have waiver under employment notes. Do you know what that means?
Well, there's one waiver. Well, yeah, actually, the only waiver that should be in there would refer to the waiver that the local sponsor had granted at the get-go when they got authorization, when they first proposed the project, really before they begin any work. At that point, by local resolutions, the local sponsor can waive the requirements at an alternative minimum level. In some cases, it has to be at or above the existing level. In some cases, they can even allow for job shrinkage within the enterprise zone. And so there are a number of companies, usually larger employers, that have trouble or worries about the 10% increase that will obtain those waivers from the local government.
And we're talking about a number of different programs, and I'd love to have this conversation about all of them, I'm going to pick on this one because it's one we're talking about.
It's the busy one.
Yeah.
It's the meat and potatoes here.
How do you think about whether or not this is a successful economic development tool? I haven't heard the phrase "but for" in your presentation yet. How do you think about, is this actually incentivizing new economic activity and new jobs and bringing businesses and allowing them to expand? Or are these things that would have happened anyway, even without the property tax exemption? How do you try and get it?
Let me go high level and then I'll let Art go detail. So this would not be a but-for incentive. This is a program that the state and then certainly run by local communities have set up. If a business qualifies, they qualify. And so our job, and much of the requirements are dictated by local communities. Our job is the zone creation. So if one needs to be expanded or or a new one proposed, and we make sure it meets requirements, and then we do provide some technical assistance just around how to interpret taxes and those types of things. But this one, if the local communities are requesting to set one up in a business and in the industries that qualify and are making the new investments that qualify, then they get this tax. It's not a but-for incentive. Now, the but-for could come in the sense of if they're deciding between, let's say, Idaho and Oregon, and knowing that they qualify to access this program puts them on a competitive cost perspective, then I guess you could say but for there. But
I guess from a lawmaker's perspective, how do we consider whether or not this is actually an effective economic development tool in our state? And whether that's from the perspective of the sponsoring City County Port or from Business Oregon, you know, are we just giving tax incentives away, tax dollars away for economic activity that would have happened anyway?
Vice Chair Fahey, Chair Lively, it is a relative question. Even when you have the best information in the world, I mean, you can never say clearly that, you know, but for this, you know, I mean, there's all sorts of possibilities. I do say, by and large, we feel that at the program level, it's having an additional effect. It's making an incremental effect. There are probably a great many small businesses that are using the program, and the amount of incentive they receive, you know, it may be a lot to them. It may make a difference, but in many cases, they might have done it anyway. We've always recognized that that's one of the things you buy into with this program. And so the local sponsor, well, when the local sponsors buy into it, whether they extend it to 5 years, they can make a judgment call in a particular situation. But by and large, it's a general program basis. And the sort of the two lines of analysis and which we want to update and look at further again is sort of your payback. And there's kind of two streams of payback. Assuming probabilistically that you're getting a certain amount of additional work, and how much of that, how quick is that payback, and how much of an assumption do you have to make as far as the additional change this makes, mostly with the larger projects that get the larger incentive by, you know, mathematically. And one line, of course, is the jobs and their ability to pay personal income tax revenue and that sort of thing. And that can be sometimes about a 6 year, 7 year thing overall for the program. And then how much of the property tax after it's been exempt and is depreciating can pay back. And those are sorts of the analytical lanes we would look at. I think in 2009, Legislative Revenue Office found it was about a 12 year payback on the property taxes, all assumptions in. So I think we need to look at it from that perspective. I mean, you can't necessarily guarantee that everyone, every time, every case is a but-for winner, but it's a relative contributor overall.
Okay. I would just say, just to wrap up, because I know we don't have very much time, that it's, you know, in my mind, an effective economic development tool is a tool that makes economic activity happen that otherwise wouldn't have happened. Otherwise, it's not an incentive. It's just...
And we feel it does that by and large, but, you know, in every one case, no.
Yeah, Vice Chair Fahey, I think part of the preamble up front of what do businesses consider when they choose a site, the talent, the cost, the quality of life, access to markets, Enterprise Zone plays into when they're comparing our cost, business cost environment to other options that they have and access to programs like that. This is the math that they do.
And it's a simple route. It's something that's kind of on the table before you get into these more special deal types of situations so that any business and variety and of size businesses can participate easily enough. Yes.
Representative Whip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What do we know about the compensation rates paid by in enterprise zones as opposed to regional based economies?
Like, are they higher than the local regional economy in general?
Chair Lively, Representative Witt, as far as companies, many of which are using the 3 year exemption, I mean, we don't know. I mean, we assume they're, you know, a lot of them are traded sector and they might pay above average compared to a lot of the service economy and stuff like that. With the extension to 5 years, except in the Portland-Salem urban zones, There is a requirement of they're receiving wage and benefits combined that at least averages on at least 130 or 150% of the county wage. So on that basis, you know, and that's those 4 to 5, those 5 year extended abatements do represent a big chunk of the of this standard program. And then the other programs on the list there also have compensation requirements to begin with as well for that sort of thing.
Thank you.
So, colleagues, this is a very important conversation, but unfortunately, the floor is about to start again. I apologize
to
you. Apologize for our Republican members had to leave. These are unusual times we're in.
Understand.
But we'll keep inviting you back as long as we have time until we can get through this. But I appreciate your time.
That was good.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Vice Chair.